Hello, everyone, and thanks so much for tuning into the KevCast. I'm your host, Kevin Winder, author of Getting Better When You Can't. This is a podcast that's designed to help you see beyond everything. I believe you'll find the content interesting, engaging, and even life-changing. Please check out my website at www.kevinwinder.com and be sure to sign up for my weekly newsletter entitled Winder's Windshield. Thanks so much for tuning in, and now on to the KevCast. Hello, everyone, and thanks so much for coming back for another episode of the KevCast. I'm your host, Kevin Winder, and I want to welcome you to Sunday. Happy Sunday. I hope your weekend is going well. I do hope the rest of it goes even better. So today is the conclusion, as promised, of our series called Is God Mad at You? We're going to be in part five, so there's a number of things I want you to go back and check out if you have not heard this series. There's four parts before this. Please go back and check them out so that you can kind of get all the threads that I've been weaving together to kind of put these thoughts here. Now, this series today does conclude, and we do so by examining the second story of the wedding feast, which mirrors the parable of the workers in the vineyard, which I talk about in a previous post. Now, I've tried to weave together a number of themes in this series because I am aware, as I've said from the beginning, that people are very set in their ways about their view on whether God is angry. They are very certain about whether God is angry or not. And this subject is embedded, and as you've probably noticed during the previous posts, it kind of pulls out certain nuances that are a part of bigger topics like salvation, atonement, or the exclusivity claims of Jesus. And for most believers, these are the subjects that are already fixed within their thinking or their theology. They are, in some cases, undisputable, unchangeable, unarguable, that if you challenge these ideas, you actually challenge the essence of their faith. And so if I come along and do a series like this, and I challenge the way that we have understood the core tenet or something like it, you can understand why there is a natural knee-jerk reaction that wants to dismiss this content. And I get this, but it's my hope to move us beyond this and expose a wider consideration. It's not unbiblical. I didn't get here by turning loose of my Bible. I got here by actually tenaciously trying to understand it. And if we're going to talk about atonement and other unarguables, let's just mention it here that if substitutionary atonement is what it claims, then Jesus became our sin, and the full anger and wrath of God was poured out on him. And there should therefore remain nothing that can stand between God's perfect love and humanity. So if God is somehow angered now by our sin or our complacency or something else, our failure to attend church or give money or our stingy hearts, if he's angered, then the substitution and the sacrifice were only partial and incomplete. And therefore, some of that wrath is waiting for you and waiting for me. And that's the story that we grew up in. That's what we've been given. Substitutionary atonement is always required if we hold to retributive justice or retribution. But a model of restorative justice, why is that so hard to say early in the morning? A model of restoration, shall I say, seems to resolve things in an entirely other way. And I recognize that this is a big frame shift. If it is going to happen at all, it's going to be a big change in your mind. And that's what this series is all about. It's about getting you to kind of look at what you believe from a different perspective, to see in these stories that we've all been taught something new. And once again, we're into a parable taught by Jesus in Matthew 22. It's It's the story that depicts what heaven is like. It's a time where a king is giving a wedding feast for his son. And the symbolism here is not at all incidental. He's talking about God. He's talking about his son himself, Jesus the Christ. And when he calls the invited people to the wedding, he's referring to the religious, the Jews of the time, his own people. He says, hey, I want you to come to the wedding feast of my son. But they ignored him. And they did so because they were too busy with their own endeavors. They got wrapped up in their own lives, as I think it's all too easy to do. And the king got angry and he destroyed the city. You know, this is right in the heart of scripture that's depicting something that's going to happen at the end of times or end of the times. And so the destruction of the city is clearly, as most scholars would agree, focused on Jerusalem in AD 70, the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction. So then following that, the king opens up the invitation to all comers, both good and bad, and he fills the wedding hall. Now that's amazing symbolism in and of itself. This wedding hall is the depiction of heaven, and it's full of both good and bad people. Ever seen that one in there before? Go ahead, check it out. I'll wait. Well, maybe not. I'll let you check it out on your own time. But there's an example in the hall. Something happened. In the wedding hall, there was a guest who didn't wear the wedding garment. And in Jewish weddings, it was proper for the host to give everybody a clean wedding garment to come in and relax. They would wash their feet. They would bring them in and, you know, they would be a part of this big celebration and recline at the table in clean clothes. But this one person there refused to wear the wedding garment and decided he would just come in with his traveling clothes, you know. And of course, this didn't go well. As a result, he's bound hand and foot and cast out into what it's called outer darkness, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's another way of saying he was cast out of the city, out to the dump, where the dogs are roaming and scavenging, where the weeping is, because these are where the outcast, the lost, the broken, the lepers all live, in the dump, in the refuge of the city. The word Gehenna is the word for hell. And so the hell symbolism here is not coincidental at all. It's saying this guy got tossed back out into the dump. Why? Because, well, we're going to explore that. Why is the king so angry? Why did the king destroy the city of the religious people he first invited who refused him? Why is the king so angry to toss out this guest into the dump? Well, the short answer is the false self. And that's why I spent last week talking all about the false self and how it doesn't really exist in reality. There's nothing ultimately real or true about it. And therefore, it's not something God can know anything about. And its only option is to be destroyed. So the king destroys the city and puts an end to the religious systems. You see, that these are the systems that trapped people into an ever-increasing set of rules. Jesus was freeing people all along when he was going there teaching in the synagogues. If you remember my post, pick up your mat. He tells the person to break the Ten Commandments and then they would be healed. He's freeing the lepers, if you remember my other post, to get rid of your system. He doesn't want to liberate them into a system. He wants to liberate them from a system, right? So instead, this religion created cultural and economic and social elites who entrenched themselves into their container rather than the contents of their religion. And we see this today. This is happening all over today, right? People of faith become elites. They won't outwardly say, hey, I'm better than you, but they have a way of saying it which sounds like this: the only difference is I'm forgiven and you're not. Right? Their otherness. They create this otherness because of their faith. And that's destroyed. Religion is supposed to bring us proximity to God, or at least point the way, and instead it often imprisons people, keeping them trapped within their own distractions of their own lives, constantly just talking about the same thing over and over and over, deferring life until after we die, and never really living it, celebrating the life and gift of our own life that's here and now, right? And eventually, that's how we, like the people in the story, dismiss the king's invitation for community. The king's inviting them to his very elaborate, intimate wedding feast, and they're too busy with their religion, with their lives, with the things, their farm, and everything that's going on. Also, the man who didn't put on the wedding garment, he's also about the false self. You see, the angry God, he's angry at the false self. That's where it's rightfully placed. The false religious self who creates a system to keep himself other than others. And the person who is represented by the man who didn't put on the wedding garment is the false self. You see, this is the self of no religion. And a lot of my audience might fit into this, right? You may not be the Christian or the person of religious faith, but you see yourself as maybe slightly smarter than that. Oh, we've come a long way, and you know, the world has gone too far to believe in that old religion stuff anymore. You know, just like this guy, he didn't see the need to put on the wedding garment. His self-appraisal was higher than reality, and he thought himself worthy, perhaps better or smarter or more clever than the others who, like sheep, just received the generosity and hospitality of the king. And his distinctions also went too far, just like the religious that we saw in the first parable. And just like the parable of the workers in the vineyard, the parable of the wedding feast both depict a heaven where God goes out and gathers any who will come. They both tell of a profound generosity that makes everyone whole and completes everyone regardless of their proximity to God. There isn't innies and outies. There isn't a two-story system. This isn't binary of right, wrong, good, bad, evil, and good. Now, both these stories depict the trappings of the religious false self and warn against the creating of distinctions that allow our pride to see ourselves as better than others or other than others. Both depict a false self. You see, pride, that ego, self-promotion, that is always expunged in proximity to God. And Scripture tells us that God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. So, is God angry? Is God angry now? Is he angry at unbelievers? Is he angry at Christians who sin? Is he angry at religious people? Not if you think anger requires retribution. You see, if you go down that road, is God angry, and you answer yes, and you have a form of retribution, then something still needs to be done. And this is where we get our ideas of these eschatologies of Jesus coming out of the eastern sky with a giant can of whoop-ass to just cream everybody's clock. It's not going to be like that. And this is eschatological scripture, and it's already telling you that it was in the past. So from these countless other stories in scripture, anger is too base of an operating system for God. You see, a God of retribution is the God we have made in our own image. And the ancient stories that we've read in the Old Testament and in other sacred texts, they all depict our low-level understanding and why we needed an angry God. But love is different, folks. Love restores all things. It completes all things. Love closes the gap between what we think we are and what we truly are. The good news is that we are not what is wrong with us, as we have come to believe. You see, love sees us as we really are. Love sees our true self. And love sees us as the love that we are. And it is the most powerful force to displace this ego, the pride, and the falsehood that we craft around our lives. Love knows and accepts us. Pride wants to make us known, but love wants to make us good. And as we move toward love, toward being the love that we are, the false parts of our lives are purged and burned, as we see in 1 Corinthians 3:13. And this process, this is the whole spiritual journey. There's really nothing more beyond it. If we add, we can add more and we can talk more about it, but there really isn't anything more. It is essentially the essence of our roads of faith. Thanks so much for joining the KevCast, where we learn to see beyond everything. I hope this content has helped you, and I'd love to hear from you if you have any questions or comments or feedback. Until next time, I hope you have an awesome day, and I can't wait to have you come back real soon.